Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company today. Now, today's guest is Dr. Liz Connor, who has spent the past decade digging into the archives to uncover the way European Australians and settlers described Aboriginal women, often in tropes and perceptions that had dangerous repercussions. And in some ways, the consequences are still seen today, in my view. It's an important and neglected subject to look at the cultural attitudes that have shaped the way Australia sees Aboriginal women. And Liz actually writes in the book that construction of Aboriginal women's gender and sexuality was a form of colonial control. Now, reading through these European caricatures of Aboriginal women, the different tropes ranging from primitive and native to bride capture to the Aboriginal mother as an infanticidal cannibal to the hypersexualized trope of black velvet, you begin to realize just how disturbing and offensive this colonial project was and how it bled into the dehumanization of us as a people. Talk to our old people and they tell you Aboriginal women were the strength, the matriarchs, truly valued in traditional society. But that's not the way, obviously, white culture has seen it. So I think this is a vitally important work to begin understanding the complexity of Aboriginal feminism. And joining us on the program to discuss it in more depth is Dr. Liz Connor. How are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you, Amy?
I'm great, and thank you so much for being here. First of all, I guess I wanted to ask you, what is your background?
I started as an academic in film. I came to academia as an activist. So that's my first and foremost kind of commitment. And I've had campaigns on, you know, the portrayal of rape, on maternity leave. I did a big campaign on native title when Howard was trying to scuttle the Wick decision, and then other campaigns more recently on climate change. And then this other half-life I have as an academic, I sort of started in film and then went through women's studies and ended up in colonial print. So I suppose I'm a visual historian who's worked mostly in newspapers and prints.
So was this accidental, I guess, that you've uncovered a lot of these really disgraceful ways, particularly I think you looked a lot at print publications, but the way they portrayed Aboriginal women, was that, I guess, accidental that you sort of stumbled across that?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that that I was actually researching flappers and 1920s modern girls for my PhD. And in newspapers like Smith's Weekly, Beckett's Budget, Lone Hand, The Bulletin, those kinds of newspapers, I started finding these cartoons and I hadn't seen anybody, you know, look at them or write about them. And at first, I just was turning them over and going, holy, that's so appalling, and they're best confined to history. It would just be hurtful and horrible to bring these up. At the same time, John Howard was saying we shouldn't adopt the black armband view of history, and the whole culture wars around the Stolen Generations and Andrew Bolt's denialism and all of that was just starting up. And I actually went back and thought, no, these people need to see these cartoons. They need to understand that for these racist and appalling discriminatory practices like the Northern Territory intervention to take place, there has to be an attitudinal base that hasn't been challenged. And that's what these cartoons describe. Because there they were in the 1920s, offensive cartoons of Aboriginal women. And nobody except Jack Patton in the Abbo call in 1948, I think, said these are really a big problem. These are part of why these terrible things can take place. And no, it wasn't accidental in the sense that the reason why I'm a print historian is before radio, print was the way we communicated with each other. So all our shared attitudes and understandings were really both reflected in print and constructed by print. So that's why I went to that archive.
And can you describe, I guess, those images and what they sort of portrayed of Aboriginal women and their bodies, I guess?
Yeah, well, the worst one I put in the introduction to show not only the racist imagery, but in the introduction I also include a few images that are really, really profoundly beautiful and show a great deal of attachment and fondness by settlers for Aborigines, which is fraught. But the really, really hateful images that could only offend and wound. I mean, really, you can't imagine an Aboriginal woman looking at these images and not feeling deeply distressed and disturbed by them. So that was another problem with writing the book, whether I be part of that by recirculating them or not. But the one of the worst ones is an image by, I think, the cartoonist Hugh McLean, who did a lot of cartoons of Aboriginal women. And I should say I concentrated on Aboriginal women because I'm a women's studies, you know, major and a feminist. And I didn't think that we'd sort of, singled out or explained how racism and misogyny are, you know, a double whammy in our culture.
Yeah.
Anyway, this particular cartoon by Hugh McLean is captured dry gin, and it's a typical, image of an Aboriginal woman from the 1920s, and that she's got a monkey's face, really skinny arms and legs, big hands and feet, really, really big splayed feet. And she's wearing like a Mother Hubbard print dress, you know, like a mission, a sign dress with a ragged hem. And she's holding over her head a big wooden bucket and underneath and drinking from it. And underneath it says dry gin. It is just hair-raisingly nasty.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first ones I found. But I found dozens of cartoons like that.
Yeah, right.
And photographs. And then there's all the textual description. And what I found was that they repeated like the image of Aboriginal women standing on the threshold of, Australian settlers' homes and stations with big splayed feet repeats again and again and again and again.
So they were all influenced by each other and what came before, and it sort of just became this accepted image of the Aboriginal woman.
Yeah. And from that, I started to think racism really requires a lot of upkeep. It's not enough to say something once. It only really takes hold if you say it again and again and again and again. So in the chapter on, it's really about how white people thought that Aboriginal women were subjected to their brutal overlords, right? So there's this idea, of course.
And the brutal overlords were the Aboriginal men, weren't they? In the white imagination, it was Aboriginal men who were the overlords.
Yeah, that's right. Not white men, which was the truth, but the black men that were actually mostly trying to defend them.
So
there's a whole chapter on what I call the bride capture trope. So white people were very fascinated in marital rituals or marital rites of the primitive people, right? In scare quotes. And they had this idea that that Aboriginal or Native or even Indigenous women all around the world never consented to marriage. They were always clonked on the head and dragged off by the hair, and eventually they accepted their subjection.
Yeah, right.
And this is how primitive people related.
And I guess there's a perception there that Aboriginal women have no agency at all. It's almost like robbing them of their agency in another sense.
Yes, so incapable of two things, incapable of agency, and Aboriginal women, Aboriginal men, and this is a kind of afterthought for me, are incapable of love.
Yeah, right.
Any kind of love. Any kind of love. Romantic love, familial love, love for their parents, you know, bit of love for their children, but if you take the children away, they soon get over it. And that's the biggest constant in all of this, is that Aboriginal people are incapable of love. And really, when you take that away, I don't know how you could dehumanise a people more, to be honest. Anyway, that's an afterthought. With the bride capture trope, that repeated again and again and again. And what I found was that there were three iterations, if you want to call that, three moments where First of all, David Collins, the Surveyor General in the First Fleet, he said it, and people literally quoted him word for word 30, 40 times and added pictures. And then a fellow called McLennan, he said it anew in a book called Primitive Marriage, and that was the second iteration. And then another 30 or 40 times people quoted him and added pictures. And then there's another iteration, and I forget it actually, a third sort of generation where it was said again and people quoted it again and again and again. And so you see this kind of repetition and you see how people sort of rely on these moments and then repeat them for these really racist ideas to sort of get to have a kind of new generation of recirculation, if that makes sense.
And that original telling of this trope, it wasn't based on fact or anything, was it? What was it based on for them to look at that and see those sort of things happening?
Yeah, well, that's why it's really important to go back to them and say, all right, what are we looking at here? David Collins, reasonably may have seen a sort of alcohol-fueled domestic violence scenario taking place on the streets of Sydney. And we know from images by Augustus Earle that already people who were sort of on the fringe in Sydney were damaged, there was drinking and there was violence. And unlike in European families, things happen inside walls, it's highly visible when things are breaking down in Aboriginal families at that time and it's on the street. He might have seen something like that. And put that together with this idea that was already in circulation before Australia was, invaded by Europeans, and that was that primitive people did three things. They ate each other, they were cannibals, they had lots of wives when they were men, there was polygamy, and they killed their children. There was infanticide. Those were the three things. That was already in their mouths before they came to Australia. And they believed that it applied to all savages in square quotes. Right. So they came here, they saw different things going on, including the terrible impact of their presence, really, and they blamed it on the people being savages. Yeah. And said this is part of them being, primitive, rather than, wow, we're really damaging these people. They really need help. We need to really think about what we're doing here.
Well, yeah, it justifies them as the white protector as well, and also for the sort of taking of their land, viewing them as savages.
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely did that. And the idea that both Aboriginal men and for higher class white men and humanitarians, low-class white men, the idea that those two groups of men were, brutally subjecting Aboriginal women was indeed the rationale for what we call the Protection Era Administration. And that was the removal of people, the rounding them up and shifting them onto reserves and missions for their own protection, which was kind of expedient, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because it was about displacement. It was about dispossession of land, of course, too.
Yeah, it's very interesting what effect these tropes had on, the attempted sort of dispossession, or actually the dispossession of our people. It's really amazing to see how they sort of bled into that. The other thing when you're talking about bride capture was obviously that it affected Aboriginal men as well, because very much so painting Aboriginal women as vulnerable and sort of vulnerable to Aboriginal men over the top of them. It's sort of, would you like to talk a bit more about that, about the fact that painting Aboriginal men as violent also sort of justified their extermination, I guess?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it's such a kind of, what's the word, projection for white settlers to project this idea that Aboriginal men are violent, and yes, sometimes they are, but to say that that's descriptive of them as Aboriginal is where we're getting into big problems. And I'll give you an example. I was a sexual assault counsellor in Bendigo, about 25 years ago, a long time ago. And, there I am, all these kids and women are coming in disclosing sexual violence by white men predominantly, in fact, mostly, 99%. There's a room stacked from floor to ceiling of disclosures and cases. all by white men, right?
Yeah.
Nowhere at any point did anyone say, this is a problem of whiteness.
No.
This is about this men's whiteness. We need to send in the army.
Yeah.
With the ukuleles and have an emergency response, right? And, you know, parts of Bendigo were in crisis in terms of the pervasiveness of sexual violence within families. So, you know, the idea that primitive men and savage men were brutal overlords and that these ceremonial scars on Aboriginal women that were part of their maturation and so on, initiation, were actually scars that men had perpetrated, and that any kind of, what would you call, I suppose we today call dysfunction, arising from the emasculation of Aboriginal men, the taking away of their livelihoods, their dispossession, the removal of their children, the raping of their women, all the trauma these men are experiencing. There's plenty of evidence for, you know, a kind of post-war conflict trauma amongst Aboriginal men.
Yeah.
All of that is about them being primitive. Basically, it's about them being primitive. It's a description of their Aboriginality. And that's a part of, I think, government approaches right up to this very day.
Oh, it's so true. It really comes, that actually really comes out a lot when I was reading the book, the fact that it's still in play today. And I want to talk to you a bit more about that a bit later. But the other thing I found interesting in this chapter about bride capture is the idea that the use of gendered violence and white concerns about gendered violence in Aboriginal societies was sort of used as an alibi for them doing really horrendous things to Aboriginal women and men themselves.
Yeah, and that's why I finished the chapter looking at, as best I can, because it really is barely reported, but that's why I look at the instances of violence against Aboriginal women. And they're so sadistic, aren't they, Amy?
Oh,
you know,
horrendous.
The one where, yeah, it's really, it must feel like being bludgeoned reading as an Aboriginal woman, I've got to say, and that was a big concern I had. But the description of the two miners, I think they are, asking an Aboriginal woman to look on the ground for their tobacco, promising, I guess, to give her some, where they'd spread some dynamite powder and then they set it on fire so that it blew up in her face so that she was burned.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of...
And no penalty for that either back in the day. So
right.
It was okay for... it was bad for Aboriginal men to... You know, there was concerns of Aboriginal men hurting their women, but nothing, no repercussions for white men who did this, and even in more horrendous ways.
None, absolutely none. And the sadism is the bit that just, you know, floors me. I mean, there's just, it's like what Patrick Wolfe says in his, you know, Patrick Wolfe, the great kind of theorist of settler colonial dispossession and settler colonialism as not just an event but actually a structure, a regime. And he talks about these, you know, effectively they're death squads. So the guys, you know, the men, the white settlers who are going forth as really paramilitary and perpetrating what is effectively terror. It's terror. And the government sort of winking and nodding and looking the other way. And it's not enough to say, oh, yes, see, they couldn't do anything about it. In fact, that those death squads and that terror was integral to the government dispossession. It was part of it. It wasn't just a kind of unfortunate side effect. And that's what, you know, when white governments make apologies even today, yes, it's true, terrible things happen. But they, you know, they were just, you know, some of the convicts. They were just some of the lower class white men. Those men were perpetrating the terror on the front line, on the frontier, that the government administrators, where the dispossession was being formalised, depended on in order to bring about that dispossession. And the terror of Aboriginal women, the sexual violence and the sadism, was absolutely part of that regime of dispossession.
It's and I guess that's why Australia has this real problem with the amnesia of history, because it's just so horrendous. I think a lot of white listeners listening just can't sort of fathom how this has happened, and they don't want to have anything to do with it, because I guess they are directly benefiting from that terrorism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's a whole lot of guilt. I mean, and I feel that too, and I talk a little bit about that, because guilt isn't very... It's not a very productive emotion. It's not a productive emotion like anger can be, for instance, galvanizing. Guilt is just, you know, kind of passive. And it also means that white fellas can do this really annoying thing that I'm sure some of your Indigenous listeners will identify with, and that is do this kind of performance and display of how, of what good fellas they really are.
Yeah.
You know, that goes on a lot. I don't have a lot of time for it. You know, for instance, I don't expect for me, as a settler, accruing all the benefits of this, to not slip up and make stupid mistakes, probably in my book and just generally in interacting with Aboriginal people. I don't expect, and I would never claim, that I'm 100% not racist. All I can say is I'm trying. I'm probably getting it wrong. But you see some white people do this really kind of performance and display of sort of, they almost compete for what I call the anti-racist tiara. And sometimes I think it's really unhelpful and it's more about them than actually wanting to try and do something.
You're listening to Let's Talk, where my guest is Dr. Liz Connor, and she's actually written a really amazing book. It's quite a long work, but it's well worth the read if you ever have time to pick it up. It's called Skin Deep: Settler Impressions of Aboriginal Women, and she spent a decade researching, going through the print archives and looking at the way Aboriginal women have been portrayed throughout history and what that meant for us as a people. It's a very, very fascinating book, and I hope you all can... you all can pick it up at some point, because I think it'll have a long, sort of long use, I guess. Now, we might go to some strong Aboriginal women. Let's go to Titter's Anthem, and after
don't
the break,
sing
I'll
me
back more
an anthem, because you don't know the words. Words are hard to remember when they mean nothing at all to the heart who's still waiting for their voice to be heard. Don't sing me your anthem when your anthem's absurd.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McQuire on 98.9 FM.
And we've talked about the bride captured trope. The other trope that you devoted chapter to is the idea of the Aboriginal mother and maternity, and particularly them killing their children. Would you like to explain a bit more about that trope and how widespread it was and what it may have justified?
Yeah, okay. Well, this is definitely the low point. And the idea was, and it was really a difficult chapter to write, you know, even as a white woman, as a mother of young kids, it was just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Getting out of my chair at the end of the day, sometimes I feel like a little granny. Just such distressing material. So how this material is going to read for Aboriginal mothers who've been subjected to child removal, and even more so now, is something that I'm really concerned about. But the chapter basically is about this idea that Aboriginal women killed and ate their newborns. And like I said with the bride capture trope, the idea that primitive people were cannibals was everywhere,
yeah.
And it was in settlers' mouths before they arrived here. In Australia, we did this especially nasty thing because I think we were especially nasty, to be honest, and especially misogynistic. We said that Aboriginal people were not only cannibals, they ate each other and et cetera, but the mothers ate their babies, they ate their newborns. And in Australia, we said they did that not because they were hungry even, but because the meat was especially tasty to them.
Like, where was this published? It just seems overwhelming to me that even anyone ever got away with publishing things like that.
Well, I think Daisy Bates, who some of your listeners will definitely know,
yep.
who had the camp at Aldea for 14 years, and she wrote, I think, 272 newspaper articles in the 1930s. She was the key point in this. She said they ate it, that the women had said to them they ate the baby meat because it was tasty to them, right? So Daisy Bates was really a big problem, but also a very ambiguous figure. But that's a whole other story. But she really kind of jumped the shark, but because by then we had anthropologists who were, you know, starting to want their profession to be far more credible and not just rely on the hearsay of gentlemen in the bush who were filling out surveys for people like, you know, Kerr, who put together the four volumes, The Australian Race in 1886. They wanted to be far more... to be able to say that their discipline was far more rigorous. So they were starting to marginalise people like Daisy Bates, who were making these outrageous claims. Nevertheless, they played a big part in recirculating these claims. And I sort of go through with this particular trope, this repeating leitmotif from, you know, early settlement right through to Daisy Bates.
Mm.
And the last person to say, not so much that they ate, you know, Aboriginal mothers ate their newborns because they were tasty meat. Fuck's sake. The last person to say this was, she said that Aboriginal mothers ate their babies, they were infanticidal cannibals, was Pauline Hanson in the Australian Parliament at the end of the 90s.
Wow, I've never heard that, but it doesn't really surprise me that she would say something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, someone like Pauline Hanson is going to say what's ready to hand.
Yeah,
and that's
right.
What's so alarming about the way racism works when you put a tracery on it like this and you see, all right, where did it start? Where did it go? Who said it? Who was repeating who? Who was quoting who word for word? Who put pictures with it? How did it change from this person to that person, from this decade to that decade? What were the key moments of its reiteration? And that's what I try to do with these particular tropes, and is put them on, you know, subject them to this tracery, because hopefully that's how we once and for all lay them to rest. Because Jeffrey Blamey was saying this on radio a while ago, not so much that Aboriginal mothers were infanticidal cannibals, but that Aborigines were infanticidal, absolutely.
Mm.
And the thing we can say about putting to one side the cannibalism part of it, right, and just going with infanticide, what studies have shown all around the world is that until women had birth control, mm-hmm. infanticide was how we managed having children in impossible circumstances.
So Western women had this, or European women had this
Absolutely.
Tradition.
Absolutely. And when they had the money, when they were upper class, they put them in what were called baby farms, where they knew they were going to mysteriously die of, you know, childhood diseases. Actually, most of them starved to death, you know. And if they didn't have recourse to that, and that's what I try to show in this chapter, is that again and again and again, there are these kind of little sentences in the shipping news that in Victoria, Aboriginal, you know, mothers kill and eat their babies. You know, just a sentence that's completely unsubstantiated. On the other hand, in the newspapers, at the same time, on a ratio of, say, 1 to 8, white women were actually going to court because named white women were going to court because their babies' bodies had been found. And who those women were mostly serving girls.
Yeah.
They'd probably been raped by their overlords and masters, why don't we call them? They wrapped up their... They gave birth in between setting the table and cooking lunch. You know, just terrific when you think about it.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Wrapped up their babies and stuffed them under floorboards.
Well, you have to be very incredibly vulnerable to even think of that as an option, wouldn't you? Like, you just can't
That's
even imagine where those mothers' heads were at the time.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, infanticide is what women have always had recourse to when they've had babies in impossible circumstances. Right. And until we had birth control, it was actually our form of birth control. As confronting and awful as that is to face, it's the truth.
Mm.
So to then pin that on Aboriginal mothers, remembering that we had just made things absolutely impossible for them.
Yeah.
If they were taking their babies' lives, maybe, who can blame them? And probably there was some instances of that. But to say that that is descriptive of their motherhood as Aboriginal is when we're talking about a really destructive and wounding and discriminating trope. For
yes.
white people to say that when there is actually documented court cases of white women doing that, for them to say, oh, no, black women did that just as a matter of course, and they did it because they were savages, without any names, without any bodies, without any substantiated eyewitness accounts. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? You know, what's going on there?
Yeah.
And what is going on there is dehumanising Aboriginal people.
It really is amazing to see which tropes have survived, haven't you? Because I've never heard of this instances in white women, and I'm sure not many people have, but obviously this particular trope relating to Aboriginal women has survived, even bleeding into Parliament with Pauline Hanson reviving it. It really makes you realise how insidious racism is and how hard it is to break it down.
Yeah, it is. And to have a respected conservative even... historian like Geoffrey Blaining reiterating his trope and to say, you know, if there's incontrovertible proof that Aboriginal women were killing their babies, to say that without saying, but there's more proof, actually. There's much better proof. There's more substantiated and there are bigger piles of proof of white women of the serving girl variety doing that to their babies. Much, 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 much more. But nowhere did anyone say, including Geoffrey Blaney in that movement, that was descriptive of their whiteness?
No.
That was part of their white maternity. Nowhere. And that's what I'm trying to get at here. You know, it's one thing to say Aboriginal women were infanticidal. Probably on occasion they were. You know, there were probably some women who'd seen their babies get to 3 or 4 and die of whooping cough, die horrible, horrible deaths, and had had 3 or 4 of their children do that in front of their eyes. And when they had babies and were so ill themselves that they couldn't feed them, they might have pinched their nostrils and let them expire. That would make perfect sense to any of us that are mothers in those circumstances. That's imaginable. But to say that that was a part of their savagery and just routine and a part of Aboriginal traditional ceremony is just nowhere substantiated. It's just not. And that's what I'm trying to get at.
Definitely. And I guess, were you able to tie some of these tropes to? Obviously, you mentioned sorry and apologies by governments before. I guess, do you tie a lot of those racist assumptions about Aboriginal mothers to that policy of removals and even today in regards to all these child protection policies?
Yeah, I do. I don't particularly in the book because, you know, as a scholar, I mean, I could a bit now in speaking about the book, but as a scholar, I mean, that was the impetus for the book, is that this racism is still continuing. Mm. But as a scholar that's trying to do a scholarly work, I'm just not well-versed enough to wade into that debate. But I would refer, you know, all of your listeners who probably already are reading, people like John Altman and his criticism of the Northern Territory intervention. So there's some really good stuff that's being written around that. But the connection is, I think, a really simple one, and this for me is an afterthought that came after writing the book. You know, rats. I wish I'd had it while I was writing the book, because I would have said, and maybe even changed the title into something about denying that Aboriginal people are capable of love.
Yeah.
That's really what's going on underneath all of these tropes, the bride capture, you know, the infanticide cannibal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Aboriginal people are incapable of love, loving each other and of being loved, because, you know, look how ugly the elderly women are, yeah, and look how badly treated they are, et cetera, mm, et cetera, et cetera. This is a group of people who are incapable of loving each other who don't warrant love from us as well, is, I think, the main thing, and that's the dehumanising of it. Once you've got that in place, and it took a bit, you know, had to be said over and over again in these very complicated and insidious ways over decades, once you've got that in place, you can, you know, reasonably start accusing a people who are having a pretty tough time of any of the kind of difficulties that they're experiencing in their family relationships as this being part of their, you know, racial identity and their business and as part of their tradition that goes back to pre-settler times. And I think that's what's going on still in the... It's unstated, but it's part of the thinking, I think, definitely, just this general idea that Aboriginal mothers and Aboriginal fathers are incompetent.
Yeah.
That's the kind of underpinning idea.
I definitely got that a lot in reading about your book, because particularly I mentioned the child protection policies. I mean, and, you know, it's sort of the rubbish sort of sprouted by Andrew Bolt all the time around the stolen generation, saying they were taken away for their welfare, you know, they were in these horrendous conditions, blah, blah, yeah, blah, blah, blah. You sort of get a sense of how that myth is sort of promoted and continued. Yeah. And I think it's very hard to educate people about why that's wrong and why you shouldn't just take children away. And I sort of see the historical basis of that in a lot of what you've written, particularly around the way Aboriginal mothers were treated. And also, I think you mentioned the chapter about the elderly. That to me was incredibly confronting, because in Aboriginal communities, the women and the elderly women are the most important, I would say, and they're the people you look up to. And I guess to hear them portrayed in their physical, you know, the physical portrayal in such a horrendous light, that really stood out to me as incredibly offensive. I think those are the bits that really stood out to me, those portrayals of the elderly women, because I see them as the strength of our communities.
Yeah, and that's why I say this is a book of lies, and those lies are still informing. So, for example, exactly, if we you know, persist with the idea that the elderly, if we don't credit elderly women for who they are and the role that they play in those communities, we also don't listen to the aunties and look at the programs that they've instituted in those communities around family violence that have been successful. And so instead of looking at those programs and going, right, let's do a nationwide rollout of the aunties programs that have already proven successful in some communities, oh no, let's not listen to any of that. You know, Aboriginal elder women, they're not anyone we need to listen to. Instead, let's bring in the army with ukuleles, for Christ's sake. You know, that's going to fix the problem. And as we've seen, it's made whatever problems were there, and there were problems, and there are those same problems in white communities, let's be frank, it's made those problems so much worse. And it also means, in terms of child protection policies, and as someone that's worked in child protection, for me the first thing is making kids safe. That's the first thing. But in the context of Aboriginal communities, where you have elder women and aunties and very diffuse patterns of care, to remove kids from communities means that you're completely discrediting all the people that can be involved in their extended care. And the elder women have got such an important role in that, and it just completely discredits them. And the second thing that it does, of course, and it has always done, is that it disinherits kids from their land and their traditions. They become disinherited. And let's be frank, that's part of an ongoing process and regime or structure of displacement and dispossession. That's what that is. And that's why it's so deeply concerning.
Oh, most definitely. And I think the core of us as Indigenous people is very much that connection to land and culture. So by taking children away, you are continuing that, really, that dispossession. You're totally right in that, I think.
And even calling them remote communities, you know. Yeah, you look at I was looking at the paintings. It's a bit off beam, but I was looking at the paintings of the western deserts, you know, and that kind of dreaming fly sort of up in the airscape. These landscapes are absolutely teeming with significance and life. They're chockers with significance and life. And we see them, you know, stuck out on the very hem of the continent from these cities. We look in and we see them as remote. Well, they're not remote. That's not how these kids are experiencing them. You know, they're right in the centre of a world of deep significance and meaning and import.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and that's just not how we don't go into those headspaces and try and see it from the inside. So we've got this very screwy idea about remote communities.
I guess when you think of it that way, it's almost just like they're the other again, you know, they're out there remote, they're the other, I guess.
Yeah.
It's another way language is sort of used and you don't realise how it's being used.
And again, I mean, I do think as someone that's worked in child protection that the first thing is you make children safe, but we've just been completely stupid about how, you know, different traditions and different and diffuse practices of childcare. The organisation of childcare in Aboriginal communities is just a completely different setup.
Yeah.
And we've brought in a regime that didn't, frankly, even suit white communities. It didn't. It's just been disastrous. And it's just, as you say, it's getting worse. There are more removals. I think I read something that you wrote, Amy, where you said 60% of those removals are around not physical and sexual abuse, but neglect.
Yeah.
You know, neglect is a problem, but, you know, it surely is physical and sexual abuse, right? Well, we've got to make their kids safe, right? But neglect, I mean, that you're calling up there a kind of a wall or a meld of problems that surely can be addressed without removing that child. I mean, I can't speak for each case, and we have to make kids safe. That's really important. But, you know, 60% around neglect, there's something really wrong going on.
Yeah.
There really is.
And you're right, you mentioned the different sort of parenting and the way children are raised in Aboriginal communities. A lot of the time I've spoken to a lot of, the people who are trying to fight against these higher rights of removal, and they'll say neglect is interpreted very differently by a lot of the people on the ground, docs workers who come in, and they don't know about those differences in child rearing and they don't know about Aboriginal communities. So they see neglect as completely different to what we would see it as. So it even bleeds into that historical thing you're talking
bourgeois,
about. Yeah,
white
exactly.
Standards. Yep. Well, you know, and again, this is going off beam a bit, but for me, the thing that describes a functional society is how we organise care of children. And we're pretty shit about that in Western traditions. We came here with 15 kids in chains, and we were taking kids off their convict mothers when they were infants. And we came to a society where there was no child poverty, there were no child orphans, there were none.
Yeah.
Every child felt they had, every child's education was, you know, carefully taken care of every moment of the day by everyone in that community, had a responsibility towards it. And every single one of those kids felt that they were indispensable to the functioning of that community. You put those two things together, for me, which one, you know, strikes you as more civilised?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I think our listeners will know which one as well.
I mean, the West is hopeless at children in lots of ways. Not in all ways, but, you know, potentially we had a lot to learn, and instead we applied this idea that Aboriginal mothers and fathers were, okay, not incapable of love. They were, in fact, very attentive and fond parents. But if you took their children away, they soon got over it. It wasn't real love, you know. And so we just completely discredited a system of raising children that we really could have learnt a lot from. And I think that's still in place in our thinking.
How do I guess we begin to dismantle that? It seems to be very hard. You talked about the fact that they sort of come into play from being repeated over and over and over again. How we dismantle it the same way? We just continue talking about this, or how do we just start to confront this? Because they have such harsh consequences on Aboriginal people in the current day.
Yeah. As a white activist, I suppose I think that for your white listeners, our role is to support the initiatives of the Aboriginal women and men who are already active in these areas. And by support, I mean, donating to their causes, doing whatever you can to recognise and share information about the programs that the aunties and the men in the communities have already had in place that were successful. And then writing to our MPs and ringing them up and saying, oh, did you know about this kindergarten that was set up by, Aboriginal women in the 1930s and it's still going strong and these are the reasons why? Why isn't your, as the local MP, do you even know about this kindergarten? How much money have you devoted to it lately? And putting that kind of pressure on governments, that's what I think. It's really important for white fellas to support the work that's already being done by Aboriginal people around these, issues.
What sort of legacy what do you hope to achieve with your book particularly, or what do you hope sort of Aboriginal community will take from it? Because I know that you were quite reluctant, obviously you even discuss it in your first introduction, you were very reluctant to even bring a lot of this up. But I guess how would you hope the Aboriginal community around Australia sort of sees it, and or what sort of place do you hope it has?
It's there was always a kind of conflict in the intention of the book. It's kind of written as an activist piece. It's a polemic. And it's written for the deniers. My fantasy all the way through was sitting Andrew Bolt down, a little bit like that scene in Clockwork Orange where they prop his eyeballs open with toothpicks.
I think that's the only way you'd get him to listen.
And putting him in front of a slideshow of those pictures, and then at the end saying, "So what? You're still going to be proud of our history of treatment of Aboriginal people? Yeah. You're still going to say that it wasn't as bad as we're all saying, really? Because here it is right in front of you." So that's the fantasy, and as an activist piece, it really was intended for white Australian audience to read it and take it in and understand a little bit better how racism works. The conflict for me was knowing that Aboriginal women might read this book and it might be a really emotionally distressing and exhausting experience, that really reading how these things went round and round and round again and knowing that these things were being said about themselves, really, their mothers and mostly their grandmothers, is just going to be, pretty depressing and awful experience. And so I've always been worried, and I'm still worried about Aboriginal readers. And I guess I'd say to any listeners, if you're going to take on reading it, it comes with a warning. And given that you already know this stuff, really, by all means, jump in and read it, because it does show the origins and the tracery. And if you want to sort of know in much more detail how things were circulated, then jump in and read it. But be aware that it's going to be pretty distressing, and you really already know it. And the book was intended by its author for white people to confront the amnesia, and hopefully to really start a conversation about what attitudes have to be in place for these racially discriminating policies and racism to still be just floating around and for it to become the soup that we swim in. And also, how does racism work?
Yeah.
Look at how racism has to be repeated, and therefore why it's so important for every single one of us to stop each reiteration to say to the taxi driver, no, the Land Council here in Newcastle isn't hopeless. I don't believe that and I don't accept that as a statement. You know, and even though if that's going to mean you're going to have an uncomfortable ride, you know, you have to say it. And I'm ashamed to say that was the taxi conversation I had, and I didn't know what to say, and I didn't challenge him. So I'm not saying it's easy, but you know, even having written this book, we have to, as best we can, and at every opportunity, jump in at these iterations and say, you know, prove it. That's just not true. Blah blah blah. Otherwise, it will just be repeated again and again and again, and that's how racism works.
I think it's also very important within our own communities as well. It sort of gives us a bit of ammunition. I know a lot of a sore point in the past has been the fact that Aboriginal women and the experience of Aboriginal women has never been central in a lot of advocacy and everything like that. So I feel it gives us a little bit of that background knowledge to use as well in that sense, that we can start putting the experiences of Aboriginal women particularly in the limelight in a way that gives us a lot more voice, because I think that's the other thing, and I think that was the other theme that ran throughout your book, is that Aboriginal women have just never had a voice in the way we're portrayed as well, and we've been used for different things. I was reading also the stuff when they went onto stations and were working as servants, you know, they were seen as it was good when they were assimilated, and so there was all those images in play around that. So I think that could be the other takeaway from the book, that it's important to put Aboriginal women central and first and foremost, which hasn't really been done before.
Yeah, I mean, we just, you know, worked so hard, you know, at corroding away, first of all, not recognising, and then corroding away Aboriginal women's authority. And we're still not crediting Aboriginal women with the authority. So it's really time to listen to the aunties and the elders and the women and of course, the men that are supporting them. I mean, what you said in the beginning in your introduction, I've heard that from Aboriginal men so many times, that it's the Aboriginal women who are the background. It's the Aboriginal women who have instigated these programs, you know, in the communities that were actually working. And they would have worked a lot better if they had far more support. You know, they were never really given a chance, were they? I think, you know, I mean, nothing could make me happier and prouder if the book actually challenges this white perception that, you know, Aboriginal women aren't the authority that they are and don't have the knowledge and the wisdom that they do, and how, you know, really, this is a wasted resource in terms of trying to address the problems that are there.
Most definitely. And I guess, what's your next sort of projects, just in closing? Are you hoping to stay around this sort of subject area, or you're planning on doing a few other things now that you've spent a decade working on this book?
Yeah, it was a long one. The project that I'm working on now, and I feel very blessed because it's an ARC fellowship, It's about prints of Indigenous Australians, because I started doing some work, because I'm a print historian, so I started doing work on engravings, a series of engravings at the New Norcia Mission that were made in Rome of the Yuard people, and then that led me into prints of Aborigines, so I'm also a visual historian, I guess. So by prints I mean engravings, lithographs, etchings, aquatints, mezzotints. And this is, it turns out, an archive that was being produced all around the world because people were fascinated in Aboriginal Australians, you know, from early settlement. And these images were being made all around the world, including here in Australia, and they were being disseminated all around the world. And what I'm finding is that there are these really, you know, quite respectful images of, say, Aboriginal people doing a kangaroo ceremony. And then another engraver, say, in London, has taken one little figure out of that group of people turning in a circle with their hands turned down, right? They've taken one little figure out and put them with a group of people who are drunk and fighting, and put that little figure in rags and kept their little hands still turning down, so that that figure has gone from being a part of ceremony to being a kind of cretinous, drunken figure in a fight. And I'm finding ways to understand racism in this imagery, how these images, again, got circulated again and again, but in ways that shifted over time from quite respectful ethnographic, you know, accuracy of ceremony to these nasty, nasty scenes of dysfunction, what we now call dysfunction and drunkenness and conflict. And so that's a kind of, to me, pretty exciting new way to show how racism circulated, but specifically in imagery.
That was my chat with Dr. Liz Connor, who is my guest today. And she's written a book called Skin Deep, Settler Impressions of Aboriginal Women. It's a really, it's a long read, but very much worth it, I think. I read it over a couple of, actually about the space of a month. It's hard reading, but I think it's absolutely essential to talk about. So that's all we have time for today. I'm hoping you can join me tomorrow for more of Let's Talk. Have a great day.